I'm Shelley Schlender with MeAndMyDiabetes.com. You may have heard in the news concerns about how red meat may increase the risk of heart disease and death. You also may have heard in the news debates about whether saturated fat is healthy or not. Up next, we offer a focus question to Ron Kraus about how the two might be connected, saturated fat and red meat. It's a mystery worth looking at. Now here's Ron Kraus. Ron Kraus, there's so much debate right now about saturated fat. Some studies saying that it's perfectly fine to have it, and yet as a standard policy in most clinics and most recommendations from institutions, it's keep your saturated fats low. Your research has been a little frustrating. You don't come out saying clearly one way or the other. Instead, you say it depends. It depends on what the saturated fat is eaten with. It's not as clean cut as we would like it to be.
So I don't know if I have to apologize for the way things really are, but that's the way they are. And it's not my fault. My job is to help people understand it in the simplest possible way. We're trying to work towards that, but simply the idea that saturated fat itself has an effect on health outside of the context of what one's eating is already a naive concept. But what we showed is that this is really more important than even we had realized when we started this work. We originally got into this because we were trying to study the effects of low saturated fat. My first studies that we published were really directed by the hypothesis that lowering fat was good for you. This was in the old days, and I came out of that background, and we wanted to study lower fat diets.
When was that? How long ago was that?
We did our first studies starting in 1989, so it's been over 20 years ago that we started off this work. So as I think about it, I'm somewhat shocked to realize how long I've been doing this kind of work. But along the way, we've learned things we didn't expect to see. In fact, for me, the most important advances, and the most interesting ones certainly, are the ones that come out with opposite results from what you started with, where you expected one result and the results came out differently. And that came out when we first studied lower fat diets, thinking that this would benefit the individuals who had higher heart disease risk, who had small particles, the pattern B profile, for example. What we found, to our surprise initially, was that when we fed these low-fat diets and substituted carbohydrate, which was at that time and still remains the current paradigm, we really didn't achieve what we had wanted to achieve. There was some improvement in cholesterol in the individuals who had the small LDL profiles, but what was really astonishing to me at the time was that the majority of the people we studied who had the normal metabolic profile, the normal LDL particles, the pattern A profile that we discussed earlier, a very large percentage of those people actually shifted into the pattern B mode. We did the equivalent of changing their hair color from red to blonde, or maybe blonde to red, by putting them on this higher carbohydrate diet. So we elicited what we think now is an underlying genetic susceptibility, which is very common in the population.
And we're not just talking hair color here. We're talking about something that actually changed their health, because those smaller particle pattern B cholesterols were more an indication of greater health risk. Bad news, it was like giving them this supposedly healthier diet that made them be more at risk.
Yeah, and we were certainly concerned about these changes increasing heart disease risk. So we turned our attention ultimately away from feeding higher carbohydrate, lower fat diets to doing the reverse, to really lowering carbohydrate. And that's where we intersected with the world of people that were very interested in very low carbohydrate diets. We sort of worked our way into studies along those lines and ultimately published a study, it was now 5 years ago, in which we systematically compared different levels of carbohydrate, keeping in one case fat constant and in the other loading it up with saturated fat. And what we found is that the carbohydrate reduction alone improved the metabolic profile in the majority of individuals independently of saturated fat intake.
Now, was that the 2006 American Journal of Clinical Nutrition study? And in that one, you had a range of carbohydrates that people ate, from 54% of their calories as carbohydrates to 26% of their calories as carbohydrates.
That's right. We had actually three levels. The low was 26, the high was 54, and then we had 39% in between.
And in some of those people, you fed them 8% of their calories as saturated fat, and in some you fed them 15%.
On the lowest carbohydrate diet, the 26% carbohydrate, we jacked up the fat content with either monounsaturated or saturated fat. That is an olive oil type of fat versus, in this case, high dairy fat.
And you didn't see much difference in what happened to them in terms of the fat. There was more difference based on how much carbohydrate they were eating.
Yes, and the improvement was clearly due to the carbohydrates.
Meaning lowering the carbohydrates generally made the improvement.
That's right. The improvement was clearly due to reducing carbohydrates.
You see, we need to say that because that's backwards from how most people think it works.
Yeah, I'd like to think that the world has come around, but obviously that's not true. We look carefully at the saturated fat effects. We did see a signal for an increased LDL cholesterol level, but when we looked more carefully, it was not the small particles that went up. And in fact, the total particle concentration, which most people in our field agrees is a really strong indicator of risk, did not show any change in response to high saturated fat.
Meaning that they still had plenty of fluffy cholesterol, which was the kind that you don't worry so much about. It's not that they got a lot more of the small particle little BBs that indicate there's a lot going wrong.
Yeah, those small particles remained low, and saturated fat didn't affect those particles at all. There was a small increase in the larger particles. But interestingly, the total particle concentration was completely impervious to the saturated fat. The large particles went up a little bit, and the small particles actually might have gone down a little bit, so the net change was no change in total particles. So by anybody's current criteria of what's important for heart disease risk, people that understand the role of high protein particles as opposed to the cholesterol, I'm sure for many people a subtle distinction, but it's the number of particles that matter. It's the number of LDL particles. These are like little balls of cholesterol circulating in the blood. Those are the particles. And just like in physics, we have to understand particles before we can understand the laws of physics. That's true for heart disease and cholesterol as well.
And so each of these LDL particles, it has a protein. I'm not going to say it right.
I'll say it. It's apolipoprotein B, also simply called ApoB.
Okay, ApoB, apolipoprotein B, is like a mesh bag that is holding a whole bunch of fat inside of it. And each of these balls has one mesh bag around it, one ApoB protein. Is the cholesterol level based on just how much fat is being held in the bag rather than how many bags there are?
Well, it's both. You can have a high LDL cholesterol level due to too many particles, no matter whether they're large or small. But the real area that I think most people, certainly in the field of cholesterol and heart disease, understand is that it's really the number of particles, whether they're big or small or have more or less cholesterol. The first order of business is to make sure that the total number of particles is maintained in a healthy range, because that's what dictates heart disease risk. Beyond that, I and many of my colleagues would argue that if one looks deeper, it's the smaller particles that account for most of that concern, not the larger ones.
Oh, Ron Krauss, so that if you have a lot of cholesterol fat in your body and it's mainly being carried in a whole bunch of little tiny particles, that's more of a concern than if you just have not very many ApoB particles in your blood and each one of them is just nice and full of fat. That's actually much better, even if it's the same amount of cholesterol both ways.
Yeah, and it's definitely associated with lower heart disease risk to have the cholesterol in larger particles. And that's because there's fewer of them. This is where one has to imagine two extreme cases, a small guy, small LDL particle and a large LDL particle. Each of them have ApoB. One has more cholesterol than the other. If you then try to normalize the cholesterol between those two individuals with a larger and smaller LDL, because the smaller particle has less cholesterol, you need more particles to get the same level of LDL cholesterol. So people, as I mentioned earlier on, who study heart disease and find that LDL cholesterol levels are not very different in heart attack patients versus non-heart attack patients, people that are healthy, if you look deeper, you'll find that the LDL cholesterol may not be elevated, but people have more of the small particles, so that their particle concentration is disproportionately high in relationship to the LDL cholesterol level.
And so if a person just counted the ApoB proteins, the number of those in their blood, if they had a lot of those, that would be a better marker than seeing how much total cholesterol is in their blood, because that would tell you if you have a whole bunch of those, then it says you probably have a lot of small particles.
Exactly right. So ApoB is a sort of a first approximation of the small particle concentration. It's not measuring it exactly, but it's a whole lot more accurate index of the risk associated with LDL than LDL cholesterol itself. And I think this is being acknowledged more widely in the field of heart disease assessment.
Has anybody told the American Heart Association this?
Well, the American Heart Association does two things. It promotes scientific research, and it makes statements from time to time. Certainly, I've been involved with that.
But you see, their statements don't reflect this yet.
No. There's still a lot of debate about whether we should be advancing beyond the old LDL cholesterol-based approach to risk assessment to understanding it on the basis of particle concentrations. But I think we're moving in the right direction. And as I said, the higher saturated fat diet that we fed, really high saturated fat, 15% versus 8%, in the setting of lower carb and a mixed protein diet, that's important for what I'm going to talk about later, proteins from various sources, from white meat and dark meat and chicken and fish and beef.
Tofu,
you know, it was just a mixed diet altogether. And so in that setting, and carbohydrate intake that was kept moderately low, saturated fat did not raise ApoB. It didn't raise any of the really meaningful indices of heart disease risk.
So that was an interesting study. And then another one that's been more recent and goes right into headlines that are happening right now in March 2012 has to do with red meat and saturated fat. And it's a fascinating study because of some interesting things that it says. Right now, there's some talk that red meat may be dangerous for people's health to eat. But the question is why? And you give a reason why in, let's see, what was that study in?
Well, we published a paper this past fall in the Journal of Nutrition in which we reported the results of a study that we carried out as a follow-on to the one we just discussed. I have to say that the first study was funded by the National Dairy Council, and we used dairy fat and dairy products liberally in that study. The second was funded by the National Cattlemen's and Beef Association, that's full disclosure, because they felt, and frankly we felt at the time, based on the evidence we had, that feeding a high versus low saturated fat with a low carbohydrate intake would have the same benefit on a high beef diet versus a mixed protein diet. And the bottom line is, when we did the study, we found that that was not the case.
And you found out that some of it not being the case also depended not only on what kind of protein that you were feeding, but what kind of fat that people were eating.
This is a very high beef diet. People are eating beef breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So this is really way outside of what we would ever consider to be a usual health practice. Maybe some people do it. But we were really interested in the metabolic impact of this diet. And so we fed it in the context of either lean beef with extra saturated fat. And the saturated fat, again, came mostly from dairy products. Most of the saturated fat we get in our diet comes from dairy. Some of it comes from beef, but a lot of it comes from dairy products. And then we fed the same beef product, low in fat, without the added saturated fat. We used unsaturated fat instead. So in both cases, we were feeding a lot of beef, one with extra saturated fat, let's say the equivalent of a cheeseburger versus a lean hamburger. That sort of describes in a nutshell, if you will, the kind of differences that we were looking for. The beef with the low saturated fat didn't seem to have any adverse effects.
Meaning that it didn't have adverse effects on the kinds of risk factors that indicate heart disease risk and that are showing up in these red meat studies as predictors of somebody dying.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we were looking at standard risk factors for heart disease, including our own measurements, and we didn't see any adverse effect if we just fed a high beef diet in the absence of saturated fat.
So a lean burger without cheese looked on the surface as the one to do.
Well, there may be other effects. There are studies now from the epidemiology world that are very convincingly pointing to red meat intake itself as having an association with risk for many disease outcomes, ranging from cancer to heart disease to diabetes. Our measurements were really strictly focused on the metabolic risk factors for heart disease and diabetes. And in that setting, we couldn't detect a real significant signal. That doesn't mean that there aren't adverse effects that are occurring through other mechanisms. But using the cholesterol analyses and sugar measurements and inflammation measurements and other detailed metabolic studies, we didn't see anything that was particularly dangerous occurring if we kept the saturated fat very low.
And yet, what's interesting is what the punchline is going to be, which is very intriguing. So keep going with this story.
Right. So the punchline is that we expected that because these diets had low carbohydrate, when we fed the high saturated fat, we would also see a pretty benign metabolic risk profile. And much to our surprise, and again, this is another one in the series of surprises that keep life interesting for us as researchers and also, I think, for the world out there who happens to be looking over our shoulder. Much to our surprise, the combination of the high beef diet plus the high saturated fat diet caused very serious increases in all of the cholesterol-related risk factors that we had been measuring, including total particle numbers, small LDL, whatever we looked at, it looked like it was an adverse effect.
Everything went wrong.
Right. And this was in contrast to our earlier studies, which formed the basis for this particular study, where the same amount of saturated fat and very similar carbohydrate intake, but a diet that was not loaded up with red meat had no effect, even though we put lots of saturated fat in it.
So if you put on your Sherlock Holmes hat and get out your magnifying glass, what is it that you found that is the likely smoking gun here?
Well, I wish I could give you an answer to that question, but fortunately, the fact that we had these two very different results from the same research program with a very similar protocol with two different kinds of protein led us to propose to the National Institutes of Health, a major funding agency for biomedical research in this country, which will hopefully stay that way, neutral grounds, if you will, between the world of sponsors from the food industry that is allowing us now to investigate in a detective-like manner what is going on, to test also directly in a head-to-head manner whether diets with the same amount of saturated fat but containing high red meat, not just beef but red meat in general, versus a non-meat diet, a vegetarian diet where the protein comes from vegetable sources, an intermediate diet, which is a white meat diet from chicken primarily, whether the context, whether the overall food profile, particularly focusing on the source of protein, influences the response to saturated fat in the way that we suspected from these earlier results, and that will allow us to investigate possible underlying mechanisms, one of which we're really interested in is the possibility that some other component of beef, not necessarily the protein, but something that comes along with it, such as iron, would be one example that may have an adverse effect in conjunction with saturated fat.
Well, you know what? In a detective novel, they talk about a red herring, and a red herring is taking someone off the track. But in this case, that color red, which is caused by the iron in meat, actually may be the smoking gun.
That's one of a number of possibilities.
Why would the iron in red meat, when coupled with saturated fat, increase the chance?
Right. So this is just an idea, and I'd have to say this is, in our whole discussion, the one area where we really don't have data, but it's an intriguing hypothesis because it's known from a variety of lines of evidence, genetic, population studies, and metabolic studies, that iron content of the liver in particular, which stores most of our iron as a repository for our needs for red blood cell production and many other metabolic processes, that amount of iron, if it's excessive, can lead to impaired sugar metabolism and predispose even to diabetes in the extreme case. It's also been shown that it can be associated with an abnormal lipid profile of the type we're interested in. So we already have evidence that hepatic iron in the liver is a potential determinant of the kinds of things that can influence risk for diabetes and heart disease and could be related to the dietary response that we studied. Why beef should have a particularly effect on hepatic iron, which would be one this possibility we're quite interested in, only when you consume saturated fat, is an intriguing collection of clues, if you will, that maybe Sherlock Holmes would be able to draw a definitive conclusion from, but we're still searching. It turns out that something called heme iron, the form in which iron is packaged in red meat, is absorbed pretty efficiently into the body. So that's why red meat is considered a, quote, good source, at least an abundant source, of dietary iron. But it requires certain factors for absorption. What I discovered buried in the literature, which I certainly hadn't known, was in checking to see why the saturated fat should potentially increase the amount of iron that's coming in from beef. It turns out that certain kinds of saturated fat, beef tallow being one of them, stearic acid, another form of saturated fat found in both dairy products and red meat, promotes the absorption of heme iron. So that the combination of having both an abundant source of iron and the fat going along with it to help absorb that iron might be what converts this dietary profile into a dangerous one.
You know, looking back in time, there was a time where people were in wars and accidents more often, where they had more parasites in their blood that would be going after the iron in the body. And so being able to conserve iron was actually protective. And these days we don't have the parasites and we don't have the blood bleeding out of us as much. So Ron Krause, if someone likes cheeseburgers and they like them nice and juicy, should they give blood more often?
Well, you ask a question that has come up in other contexts as well, is that is, does keeping people's iron level low reduce the risk of heart disease? And there's been people that have claimed that women who have a natural protection from heart disease while they're menstruating, perhaps part of that is because they have lower iron stores. That's never really been proven. Does giving blood and reducing your iron stores reduce heart disease risk? We don't know. It'd be very interesting if we could answer that question. The real way to do that is not even from knowing what your diet is, but knowing how much iron you actually have, how much of the potentially dangerous iron you have in your system. And there are ways to assess that, and that might be a more useful index. But there's absolutely no basis yet for therapeutically reducing iron stores as a means of reducing heart disease risk. The way to do it, of course, is to stay away from the cheeseburger diet.
However, you also told me that it's very hard to tell what the heme level of iron is in the liver. It's a very, very hard bit of data to go to.
Yeah, I mean, there are markers that are can be measured in the blood. We haven't measured all of them yet. We're part of the funding that we are getting from the NIH grant, this new grant will allow us to measure these more accurate markers. And so it may be possible to tease out that information, but the standard iron tests in the blood are not sufficient, and that's where we need more information.
I'm Shelley Schlender. You've been listening to Ron Kraus in an interview recorded in March of 2012, talking about the issues that may involve whether or not saturated fat is safe to eat or not. To find out more, check meandmydiabetes.com. And thanks to Walt Schlender for the whistling.